Today we begin a new teaching series on the book of Daniel, a man of a single solitary devotion to God, living faithfully in a foreign land. And as soon as I say the word Daniel, the name Daniel, the figure of Daniel, many of you probably have stories that come into your mind. Maybe at first you think of Daniel and the lion's den, right? Daniel, the lion's den, he's there, there's these bloodthirsty lions, and the Lord himself rescues him from peril. Maybe that's the first thing that comes to mind. Maybe some of you think of Daniel's friends being thrown into the fiery furnace and it going so hot, and again, the Lord himself rescues him. So maybe that comes to your mind right out of the gate. And so many of these stories are deep within us because maybe not all of us, but many of us, we have heard these stories read to us from the earliest times of our consciousness, like primary version picture Bibles, we remember these stories. And so the book of Daniel is broken up into roughly two halves. And a lot of those stories that I just said and others are in the first six chapters, the first half. And the second half is a bit more mysterious. And in fact, generations of scholars have scratched their heads about some of these parts of Daniel because they include four apocalyptic visions from Daniel about the end of days. And so we are going to unpack and explore all of this over the next 4 months. But before we jump into the text and before we jump into the series as a whole, I'd like to put a picture into your mind. There's a Swedish writer, Selma Lagerlöf, and she tells a story of a knight from Italy. And this is the Middle Ages, like knight warrior knight. From the Middle Ages, and this is the time of the Crusades. And so he goes to the Holy Land, and he finds himself outside of the tomb of Jesus, right after Jesus was crucified, and the tomb from which he emerged at the resurrection. Anyway, there, and he lights this candle. And it's so special to him because this is the candle of Christ. This is the light of Christ, and he's lit this right outside the tomb of Christ. And so he makes this vow to himself to bring this light of Christ all the way back to his hometown in Italy. And think of how hard that would have been. And so he has to deal with the wind. He has to deal with the candle not going out when he goes to sleep at night. At one point, he gets attacked by, you know, highwaymen. So all sorts of horrific things and hardships, you know, come upon him. And yet he perseveres. And finally, he returns to his hometown in Italy. And he can say, this is the light of Christ brought from the very tomb of Christ. But something has actually happened to him through the process. He left a warrior, someone who is capable of dark, dark things, but he returns a totally new creation, all because of this single-minded devotion to the single light of Christ. It changed him. Devotion. So with that picture in mind, I want to provide a few pieces of background to the setting, to Daniel 1. And this is important because it really helps set us frame up the context, not only for this chapter 1, and we're going to look at roughly a chapter a week, but also for the series as a whole, okay? So God's people lived under both blessing and warning. If they were faithful to God, good things would happen, and if they were unfaithful to God, and if they turned away from him, judgment would come. And they were told this explicitly in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 4, and 28. They also heard serious warnings from people like the prophet Jeremiah and the prophet Isaiah. And yet not only did the people of God neglect the law of God, not only were they unfaithful to him, but they started to prostitute themselves to foreign pagan deities. Foreign pagan deities. So I don't know if you've ever seen someone actually be slapped in the face. Hopefully it's never happened to you, but it's a shocking, insulting thing, right? And so God's people turning from their creator and redeemer and actually prostituting themselves to these foreign pagan deities, spiritually speaking, is like a slap in the face to the Lord. And this had happened time and time and time again, despite the warnings. And so after a lot of patience, and we can't presume that God is impatient because Scripture says the exact opposite. God is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. He's slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. So after he corrects them and brings them back to center, corrects them and brings them back to center, corrects them and brings them back to center, time and time again, time was up and the hammer was going to drop. Now this happened through a strong foreign nation named Babylon and their very powerful, influential king, called Nebuchadnezzar. And so on the surface, it looks like Babylon's in charge as they besiege the nation and as they take over the nation's capital, Jerusalem. But really, they are being used as a tool by God. Okay, so our timeline is roughly the 6th century before Christ. So this is like 2,600 years ago. So let's jump into the beautiful, inspired, majestic, inerrant Word of God. Verse 1. Reading from the ESV. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So this is, the year now is 605 BC. So that's historically where we are. And this is one of the most dramatic and upsetting moments in the entirety of biblical history. And so you talk about big, disastrous things. This is near the top of the list. And so for us to get our minds into how horrific this was, imagine a foreign nation, a foreign king and superpower coming in, taking over our nation, taking over the nation's capital, our leaders, burning many of our homes, burning many of our churches. Imagine them killing many of our friends and family, all these sorts of horrific things, and exiling most of the people away to be slaves in a foreign land for 70 years. When we start to think about that level of what's going on, that kind of gets us close. Verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, meaning into the hand of the king of Babylon, with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, which is an old word for Babylon, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. So one of the things when this happens, they come in, they're taking the valuable things from the temple treasury and taking them out to the foreign land. And one of the things we need to see here is that even this is unfolding according to prophecy. It's unfolding according to a plan. And here's another one of those critical pieces of background which helps us really understand what's going on a variety of levels. Over a century earlier, there was a king named Hezekiah, and he got ill, but he recovered from his illness. And so many people sent him congratulations, and there's even some foreign visitors, some dignitaries who came to offer their congratulations to the king. And there was this group of strange visitors who came from Babylon. So they come, and Hezekiah, in his pride and arrogance, now that he's healthy again, he opens up the treasuries. Here's all the nation's riches. Hey, look at all this. Look at all this stuff we have. And they're like, that's really nice. And then they leave. And then the prophet Isaiah comes up to King Hezekiah and says, you idiot. That's a paraphrase. He doesn't say idiot. Moron, no. But he kind of says a prophetic version of that, and his words to Hezekiah are captured in Isaiah 39. Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. Okay, so this is all happening. Well, we read in Daniel 1:2, it's all happening according to what Isaiah said, but there's more information. He continues, behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house, nothing shall be left, says the Lord. Verse 7, and some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Okay, so we're to see not only that this is a fulfillment of prophecy and a lot of the stuff, the valuables are taken away, but we also learn that some of your own sons will be taken, which is most likely a reference to Daniel and his friends, who we will soon be introduced to and who we will also soon learn will be exiled to Babylon. They will serve as eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. What does that mean? The word eunuch itself means emasculated. The idea here is that someone has their genitals removed. So the idea here, now why would that happen? Why would that be something that happens to people as they serve in the king's court? A couple of reasons. First of all, that person could not be a threat to the king because the eunuch could not have their own heirs. Could be no lineage from them. Second, that person would not be a threat to the king's harem and to the king's concubine and wives and everything else because they can't have sexual relations, right? So is this what happens to Daniel and his friends? Well, the word eunuch can be used in the way that I just described, but it could also be used as a high-ranking official. So there's a bit of ambiguity, and we're never totally told for sure. However, we will learn later on in the story and in the chapters that Daniel will actually come to work for the chief eunuch and official. So I think there is a high probability that based on this prophecy and based on what we see playing out, and we never learn of Daniel getting married or having kids and everything else, there is a high likelihood that he and his friends were medically castrated as they were taken away to a foreign land to serve the king. And this is not only something that's painful and about control and losing things that are going on in your life, it's about losing hope in a sense. Maybe he wanted to have kids. Maybe he wanted to have children. All of that was most likely dashed. Verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, right? This is early, so it would have been before any possible castration, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So it's the language of the Babylonians. So the idea is they want to bring not only valuables from the temple, they want to bring human resources. In fact, they want to bring young people. This is the brightest and the best, the cream of the crop from the royalty and the nobility. And we have to just pause and think of the human dimension here for a second. Daniel, at this point, is probably 15. He's a young man. What are most people doing when they're 15? Well, they're in high school. They're thinking about maybe next year I'm going to start to get my driver's license. Maybe thinking about members of the opposite sex. They are thinking about hobbies. What's my life going to be? You've got your whole life spread out before you. I did this search about popular activities for 15-year-olds in North America. Some of the things that came up, right, are hanging out with friends, watching or making videos, gaming, going to the beach, developing a hobby like photography. None of these things would have been possible for Daniel and his friends. Now, they have to go from where they are in Jerusalem to Babylon. Now, we're not told specifically about the journey, but because of historical records, it may have been the case that they had to endure a death march. So sometimes prisoners are stripped naked, chained together, and paraded to their destination. Now, a straight line from one to the other would have been about 550 miles or 885 kilometers. And so I've got a map here. I'll put it up. It's a bit small, so let me explain a few things. On the left, you see the fire. And so the idea, that's Jerusalem being besieged, right? On the right, you see, excuse me, a castle, and that is Babylon. But if you go straight as the crow flies, you have to go through the Arabian desert, which is not very hospitable to travel. And so most likely they took a common trade route up around through the north, which is represented by that red arrow. And many people would have died on this. So if you don't go as straight as the crow flies through the desert and up through the north, the equivalent is like walking from Toronto to New York City and most of the way back. So did Daniel and his friends have to do that? Well, maybe. However, because they wanted to use them in the royal court, they could have been a part of caravans, right? Because they wanted to preserve their health and well-being. We're not totally sure, but either way, it would have been a long and difficult journey. Verse 5, and now we're in Babylon. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. And so according to other ancient records, this is totally in keeping with the time of training. Verse 6, among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And here we meet them by name. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. So what we can't miss is that they are being taken over. They are being assimilated into the culture. Right? All of their names in Hebrew are beautiful, wonderful names. Right? Their families would have thought about these beautiful names, and then their names get changed, actually, and the new names reflect false pagan deities, the powers behind which are actually demonic. This is about affecting their identity and religion. For example, here's some examples. One, Daniel, the name, beautiful name, it means God is my judge. The new name, Belteshazzar, means, O lady, wife of the god Bel, protect the king, false pagan deity. Second, Hananiah, beautiful name, the Lord Yahweh is gracious. Changed to Shadrach, command of Aku, which is the moon god, false pagan deity. Mishael, who is what God is, beautiful. Changed to Meshach, which means who is like Aku, Again, false pagan deity. Fourth, Azariah means the Lord. Yahweh is a helper, changed to Abednego, servant of the shining one, Nebo. Again, false pagan deity. What if someone came into your country and took over your nation and burned your house and killed many people in your family and said, no, your new name is servant of the serpent. How would you like that? You wouldn't like it very much. Let's also not miss the fact that Daniel and his friends are at this point in their mid-teens. They are paying the price for the spiritual sins of their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. They're teenagers, right? What do we learn back in the Old Testament? You slap the face in the Lord, you turn away from his ways, you engage in false pagan worship, and there are actually consequences. What do we learn in the Ten Commandments? Right? The iniquities of the fathers will be visited on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. They're paying the price. Their whole generation is paying the price. Not only that, but to put salt in the wound, they're given new names which actually reflect the false pagan deities that their ancestors worship, which got them into this mess in the first place. This is about control. Imagine a colonizer comes in as a young indigenous child. No, that's not your name anymore. I'm going to give you this new name. It's about erasing identity, culture, and religion. And this is exactly what is happening with Daniel and his friends. In light of all this, Charles Spurgeon describes what's happening to Daniel like this. He's a captive whose very name had been changed in order to make him forget his country and his God. Verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. So they're there, they're in this course of training, they're eating from the king's table. Are they actually sitting with the king? Not at this point. They're just having the abundance from the king's table. And I'm getting the sense that, you know, Daniel is trying to exercise the one final shred of control that he had left. What was it about the food that would have been defiled? We don't know. The text doesn't tell us. Was it not prepared according to the law of Moses? Was it not kosher? Was it offered to pagan deities previously? We do not know, but Daniel is saying no, and he's trying to leverage the only amount of control he has left, verse 9. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear the Lord, my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths eat the king's food, be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So the idea is the king wants all these people strong and healthy. Here's a lot of food in abundance. And he's like, no. Give us just vegetables and water. And the word here for vegetables is more like grains. So this is meager. This is like grains and water. This is all. So he's saying, I choose rather to be loyal to God and survive on this meager diet. And I just think, again, in historical context, we can't miss the fact that these are teenagers. So much of their hope has been destroyed. Families, friends, most likely killed. At this point, they've probably been medically castrated. They're there. Why not enjoy the king's table? He probably has a wine cellar the size of the West Edmonton Mall, right? Like, there's this phrase, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. There would have been many who were like, yes, let's just have at it because so much in our lives has been destroyed forever. But Daniel and his friends are a picture of single-hearted devotion. No, we will stay true to God and we will rely on him, not the abundance of the king's table. Verse 14, so we listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So this is a first victory. This is a first victory that they have, and their strength is coming. It's clearly not from the grain and the water. So we're seeing that the Lord's hand and favor is on them and will work through them despite all the horror and catastrophe. So this is a clue to us in the text. Verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So they're given not only physical strength, but they are given intelligence. And that comment about vision and dreams tells us there's something spiritual about the knowledge Daniel has as well. Verse 18, at the end of the time when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. So at this point, we assume that the 3 years have passed. They're probably 18, maybe 20, and they're at the top of the class, highest marks, amazing. Verse 20, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. So this is high praise, 10 times smarter, and two categories of people. So it was customary to have these people, magicians and enchanters, advising the king. You're like, that sounds familiar. It's because those groups of people were also advising Pharaoh back in Egypt. So we're going to get into some more parallels with Egypt next week. But the idea here is, who are these groups? Well, magicians, and I'm not talking about people, you know, juggling on the street, but people actually who practice magic, they practice what we would call the dark arts. So initially, some of them don't even realize, but they're kind of summoning demonic power to try to manipulate what we experience around us through a series of spells, rituals, etc. Enchanters is really a kind of a general term. Here in this context, it's a loan word. But the idea is that there are people who are trying to speak with spirits in the unseen realm. And here, what we are learning is that Daniel, 18 or 20 years old as he is 10 times better in his intelligence than all these people who were advising Nebuchadnezzar. Now, as a side note, I want to share this before we move on. I think this is a fascinating detail, which I love, and I think that many of you will appreciate as well, especially given the season that we have been through. And it has to do with the wise men visiting Bethlehem, trying to find Jesus in the nativity story. And I hadn't really thought much about this, but Paul Sackosoff shared this in a sermon about a year ago, the Reverend Paul Sackosoff. And so I looked more into it. It's really this fascinating detail. I'll put up a timeline here. Consider this. So in the 8th century BC, Micah prophesies that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. Okay, we know that from the story. Fast forward to our story today with Daniel. This is the 6th century BC. Daniel is exiled to Babylon, and he rises as a prominent wise man. So he would have had learning in the Bible, etc., and he rises in prominence, as we will find in the following chapters. In the 1st century, Jesus is born in Bethlehem, and wise men, magi, come from the east, whom scholars largely, as far as I can tell, conclude is Babylon. And they come to find Jesus in Bethlehem. Have you ever wondered, why are these magi traveling all the way from the east to find this? Might it be the case that Daniel shares this information about the coming king, and he is so authoritative, he becomes so influential, that basically the magi are the spiritual heirs several generations later who have preserved that detail and actually go west to try to find the newborn king? It's possible. Fascinating detail. Continuing, final verse. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. So at first, this doesn't seem very important to us, and we'll talk more about Cyrus later, but King Cyrus will come in, he will eventually defeat the Babylonians, but that doesn't happen for 70 years. And so the idea that we are to learn here is that Daniel's boyhood home, gone. All those dreams of the future, maybe this is only going to be something he's in captivity for a couple of years. No, he will serve forcibly in this court for the vast, vast majority of his whole life. And this is the word of the Lord. So as we start this series about Daniel, we are faced with a very stark question. It's this: who are you when absolutely everything is stripped away? Your home, your family sometimes, your achievements, your identity, maybe even your health, your name, gone. Who are you in those moments deep down? And the reason I ask this question is because Daniel's experience, and we're only in chapter one, begs us to ask it. Who are you when absolutely everything is stripped away? Quick summary of what we have learned so far about Daniel. His ancestors had betrayed God repeatedly. They didn't listen to the law of Moses. They didn't listen to Isaiah or Jeremiah. Time was up. As a result, judgment came on his nation and in his entire generation. We are, in fact, all connected. Daniel was most likely around 15 when he had this happen. He would have had instruction in the Bible and would have just been starting his whole young adult life, just stretched out before him. God's judgment on the nation came in the form of a foreign superpower, Babylon, and their king, powerful as he was, Nebuchadnezzar. Their takeover of Judah and the capital city of Jerusalem came in three stages. Daniel and his friends were deported during the first. And in case you think that Nebuchadnezzar was a pushover, later there's a king named Zedekiah. Nebuchadnezzar killed all his sons before his eyes, then gouged out that king's eyes and had him marched to Babylon as well. This was a ruthless time. It is reasonable to assume that many of Daniel's friends and family were killed during the invasion, their homes lost, and property destroyed. They traveled to Babylon, perhaps in a death march, stripped naked with chains, but perhaps not, because he was of noble lineage and they wanted to use him in the royal court. But it was a trip that would have been difficult, most likely at least 1,200 kilometers. Daniel and his friends were possibly castrated upon their arrival to better serve the royal interests and not to be a threat to the king's household. If true, all hope of children or grandchildren, gone. They have their names changed to reflect false pagan deities, most likely in an act of assimilation that was meant to force them to forget their identity, culture, and religion. Ironically, their new names are more reminiscent of the false god that their ancestors worship, which got them into this trouble in the first place. They undergo a three-year training period to serve the very same king and nation who has just destroyed almost everything they know and love, and through it they remain loyal to the Lord, wanting and choosing to depend on him for strength and guidance as opposed to the abundance of Nebuchadnezzar's table. Charles Spurgeon once had a sermon called Dare to be a Daniel. And some of you know that because it became a child's hymn. Dare to be a Daniel. We read the list of all the stuff that happened to him and we're like, I'm not so sure I want that. An incident at Vichy, Arthur Miller describes a horrible scene, and it's an upper-middle-class man, a Jew, and their town is being occupied by Nazis, and this man is defending himself, and he presents his achievements, his academic degrees. He presents letters of reference from other respectable people in the community, and the Nazi guard takes all these, and he says, is this all you have? Is this all you have? And he nods yes. And the guard takes them, crumples them in the basket, and says, good, now you have nothing. Who are you when absolutely everything is stripped away? What if all your accomplishments were taken away, all your possessions, all your money? What if you lost family members and friends? What if your house or apartment was no more? What if your health evaporated? Who would you be deep in those moments? Would you reject God? Where is he anyway? Where are you? Or would you turn to the only one who is actually in control, even though everything in your own life is spinning out of control? Would you, deep within yourself, the very deepest places of your soul and your being, would you entrust your past, present, and future to your Maker and Redeemer, the only one who actually knows what is happening, even though you don't know what is happening, and he is on the lookout for faithful servants who will share his light in some pretty crazy darkness? You see, Daniel had catastrophic things happen to him. But here's the thing. Daniel wasn't really serving the king of Babylon. Daniel was serving the king of heaven. And his is a story of incredible and resilient faith, single-minded devotion, single-hearted devotion to the light of his God, no matter what. And it changed not only himself, but the world. Who are you when absolutely everything is stripped away? Let's journey together through the book of Daniel and learn together. Amen.